Bruce Pascoe is a prolific writer of fiction, non-fiction and essays. His best-known work is probably the massacre history Convincing Ground. He spent much of his time over the past few years researching Aboriginal history and languages. The Wathaurong language in particular, it's one of the Victorian languages. But his latest books are Dark Emu, A History of Aboriginal Agriculture, and it's forthcoming. The other one is Fogadox, a heartwarming fiction about solitude, mateship and dying, set in the Victorian bush. Bruce Pascoe's tried his hand at a few different occupations over his life, earning a living as a teacher, a farmer, a fisherman, a barman, a farm fence contractor, a lecturer and a book editor. In this fascinating interview, Bruce talks about the lack of intellectual curiosity about certain aspects of Aboriginal history. And it's very much the intellectual and philosophical core of Dark Emu. And it follows Bill Gammage's award-winning The Biggest Estate on Earth, which covers very much the same topic. But I started by asking Bruce Pascoe how long he's been writing.
Since I was 25, and I burnt the first two, so they're gone. That was a very wise decision.
You burnt them?
Burnt them. They burnt quite well.
What was wrong with them?
They were no good. And I'm a great reader, and I think I have a fair take on what is good and what's not. And I was, you know, the first things, not the first things I'd written, but the first long things I had written. Some of my stories to that point had been okay, but the novel, I got so immersed in it that I was unconscious of the stream. I was also very young, and my style changed from month to month. I was growing up, becoming interested in different things, finding new techniques. So I was a full-time teacher, doing other jobs as well, playing football, and I'd get back to writing it, and I was a changed man, a changed writer. And when I went to reread it, I couldn't believe how different the start was to the finish. So I had a wood stove, and I thought, nah, this is a good place for this.
And it was in manuscript form, so it was easy enough to destroy. It hadn't been printed. Yeah. It was handwritten.
Handwritten, my grandmother's fountain pen. Mm. Still got it.
But you have had a long career. And, you know, I think some of the people will remember you, of course, from First Australians. Of course, you were very much part of the documentary series that went to air on SBS TV. But let's talk about the latest work, Fogadox. There's a real, it seems to me, a very strong sense of affinity with the landscape and also with the animals. And even that introduced species, the fox.
Yeah, well, there's that ambivalence, isn't there, that I felt that myself when I was writing it, because I, you know, I'm a bushman. We're supposed to kill cats and foxes, and which I have done in the past, but I found that when two fox cubs ran in front of my car a few years ago, I couldn't accelerate. They're a beautiful animal anyway. I've always been impressed by their intelligence. The look in their eye is a wonderful thing. But at the same time, they're an invader and a very invasive animal. And for an Aboriginal person, you know, you build that parallel very quickly in your own mind. But you're ambivalent to all invaders because, you know, some of them are very intelligent and very kind and... So even though you might have a political position, you've also got to deal with the individual. So, you know, it's a funny life.
The arc of the story, though, of Fogadox. Why is he called a dox?
He's not quite a fox and not quite a dog, so he's a dox. And I'm very fond of the book because it honours some Aboriginal men who were very close to me. I was always very, very impressed to see these big, tough men with hands like the top of kerosene tins feeding scrub wrens at their kitchen table. And I thought, I was a young man when I saw these people, and I thought, there's a lot of different ways of being a man, isn't there? Because I was a footballer, so I was getting one slant on them, you know, the macho Australian male, and this other slant of these men who were twice my strength and twice as capable and four times as sensitive to the bush. And it really struck a chord with me that there's lots of different ways of being a decent person, and there's lots of different ways of reacting with country. And those old Aboriginal men, they told me that, and it was at a time when I'd known at an early age that there was an Aboriginal context to our family, had ignored it. I see people doing it all the time now, and it upsets me. It must have upset a lot of people around me at the time, and I didn't pay much attention to it. But I was, you know, I thought there were other priorities. But by the time I saw those men, I realised that there's something very important going on in the country, and I was missing out on it. I was deaf to it. And so they grew me up. Even though, you know, I saw them rarely, but those visits to their bush camps and things like that, gee, they were important moments in my life.
Mm-hmm. That sense of affinity, it sounds to me, I mean, you described yourself there as a bushman, but that sense of affinity is something that has, that continues to grow and to strengthen the affinity with the land. I mean,
yeah. Look, it's why I live at Mallacoota. I love the place. It's not my people's land. Mm. Pretty close, but it's not. But I taught there as a school teacher, and I couldn't believe the beauty of the place. I couldn't believe the solitude and the richness and the vibrancy of the community. It's a little bush community, but it's a strong arts community. I loved it. But because it's remote, you can be on the river there and fish all day and see nobody. And I was thinking about it coming up today to Melbourne, and I was thinking what I would give now to listen to a cormorant laugh. Because a few nights before, I always fish at dark because I put in a full day's work, and then I just go out around dusk and have a bit of a fish. Half the time I haven't got any bait with me. I've got two stubbies and that's all. And I'm not intending to catch a fish. I'm there giving myself an excuse to sit down. And the cormorants were going to bed in the tree above me, and they've got this funny little goat laugh. When they roost at night, you hardly ever hear it, but when they roost, they go, like a little goat. And I was sitting there at great peace with everything, and I was smiling. And I thought, this is a very strange human reaction for a man to be smiling to himself in the dark. But it's why I love where I live, because you can do that. You know, the country calls you to do that. To be happy. That's what the country wants. It wants you to be serious but happy. And I can't live anywhere else. I have to live around that beauty. You read my books, they're all about beauty. They're not about ugliness. I don't like ugliness. I don't know why people do. We read lots and lots of crime novels. We see people getting slaughtered. I saw Snowtown, the movie, the other night. Intriguing movie, beautifully made, but people killing other people, you know, it's we celebrate it too much.
Hmm. Now, Bloke, it's a couple of years now since it's been published. It's out of print, though you were saying. What was the idea with Bloke?
Look, these people in my novels, they're people I've met. I don't have enough time for imagination because the real world imposes itself so much, and I think, well, I'll get around to imagination one day, but this character and that character and that character, this situation, cormorants goat laughing in the tree, has to get in the novel. I'll use my imagination later on. You know, when I was a kid, I had a fabulous imagination. I'm sure I still have it, but the real world has imposed itself on me so urgently that I'm... I go, oh, no, I'll wait, you know. I better do the goats laughing in the tree first. I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to.
So the real world is such a... It weighs so heavily, I suppose. And, you know, the imagination is a place where you go when the real world isn't that compelling. But you're saying to me the real world is so compelling.
Mm.
It forces its way into the novels.
Well, we're surrounded by Aboriginal cultural history down there. You can't walk very far without coming across one of the old people's camps. So you know that the spirit of the country is very strong, and it creeps up on you when you least expect it, although an intelligent person would be expecting it, but it always seems to surprise me. Suddenly you're listening in a different way to the country and realising that there's a lot being said, you know, through the... We've got bowerbirds down there that have different voices. We've got lyrebirds that use everyone's voice, including your own chainsaw. And so once you're alert to birds, there's this conversation going on around you all the time. And they're not just going chirp, 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 like a dog goes bark, 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 like that famous Larson cartoon, which said, had a picture of a dog going bark, 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 interpretation, the dog is going bark, bark, bark. whereas, you know, a blue wren can be telling you all sorts of things, you know, from the very basic, like snake here, to I'm going to pick up this white petal off the tea tree and I'm going to take it to my one true love, which they do. Terribly sweet thing to see. Mm. And you think, how profound is that? How delicate? How, you know, visceral is that for a little bird to try and charm? Mm. It's quite wonderful.
It's magic, magic. Now, you've also, I mean, one of the things about you is that your writing is not, you can't really define it because you've worked on, you've created historical works of non-fiction, of course, but you've also, you know, there are other works of fiction, and I think you've written for kids as well. You've done a language dictionary, the Wathaurong Language Dictionary. What's the form that you prefer?
I'm a storyteller. Mm. I was very fortunate a long time ago to have the benefit of Maureen Watson's company in a trip around the Northern Territory. And I was publishing Australian short stories at the time. I was begging Maureen, please, can I have one of those stories that she'd told all around the territory? You know, she had millions of them, and each day seemed to have a new story. Some of them she was making up as she spoke. I know that for a fact. But I'd say, Maureen, please, let me use those. And she'd get all, you know, old black lady huffy and wouldn't talk to me. And so when the tour was over, I wrote to her. I said, oh. She wrote back saying, I'm a storyteller. I'm not a writer. I just tell them. And that was a very interesting thing to say. And I couldn't say it about myself because I just can't keep a pen out of my hand. I love the process of writing. It's my way of trying to make sense of a complicated world. The more you learn, and the older you get, you begin to learn more, the more complex it becomes, the more you find yourself being aware of the subtleties in human nature. So nothing is black and white anymore. Your judgment becomes much more sympathetic. Well, hopefully it does. And that enriches the novel. And I love telling that story, which is answering your question now. I love telling stories, and the novel is probably the form I like most, although a lot of people, you know, have read more of my short stories than they've read of my novels, but that's an opportunity everyone can redress in the bookshop.
Now, those works of historical non-fiction, people remember Convincing Ground. There was also one about the Otway Coast. It seems to me that your life had a focus down there in that part of the world.
Bass Strait is the focus. I grew up on King Island, Cape Wickham Lighthouse, one of the tallest in the Southern Hemisphere. Spent 20 years at Cape Otway, where my son grew up. And now we're into our 12th or 13th year back in Mallacoota, where I'd lived before, with Gabo Island Lighthouse. So there's the triangle, but the Aboriginal side of our family comes from Port Sorrel in Tasmania, another lighthouse, all around Bass Strait. I wrote a book, a novel called Ocean, and it began with a little story about my mother, and that was the only little glimpse that I had about her past. I built a whole novel around it. The same with my father, and his novel was called Earth. He told me one little story about his grandfather, and coincidentally I found a photograph of that man the other day. It had been in the album all the time. This dark man's there. Why don't you take an interest in this man? Because that page had always been turned very quickly mm-hmm. in the family, and I don't know, but anyway, I pulled it out the other day to show someone, and on the back of it, my father had written, Grandpa, Pan Hill, 1938. So then I was able to race back to the family history and find exactly who that man was. He lived around the corner. When I was alive, I never met him.
This is your paternal grandfather.
Mm, yeah.
There's a message to you in that that inscription on the back of that photograph.
Yeah. My father knew a little bit more than he told me, I'm sure. And my grandmother, that was her dad, she knew a lot. And she had to because he was living very close, lived around the corner from my auntie. And we were close enough to him. I never met him. And I wonder why you would avoid that. You know, had there been some falling out? Was there shame? I don't know. Anyway, I found out. I was able to... That photo falling out allowed me to make a couple of links. And I was really pleased to be able to... I was able to send that photograph to my family in Tasmania because they'd never heard of this man. I'm working with an Aboriginal work crew at the moment trying to up the... educational levels and cultural heritage knowledge of young unemployed Aboriginal people. We're working with people whose educational standards almost don't exist, whose health is terrible, whose eating and smoking habits are, drinking habits are awful, whose poverty is self-evident. And we're just working with those people because we need educated Aboriginal people in our community. We need people to be looking after their children. We need people to be doing cultural work. There's not enough of us to do the work that has to be done. And I'm desperately looking for people who can use a computer, you know, something like that, so they can help the community. And so that we're doing this training. Anyway, we go down on the river one day because we've been told that there's an Aboriginal site down there. We find these axe grinding grooves in near the waterfall, and I've got a dozen young Aboriginal people there. Seven of them are related to the people who made the grooves. Now, one of the families there, I'd been in their lounge room. I'd seen the photograph of their father's grandmother, righto. Just to get it exact. And I said to the girls who were in there with their Reeboks and their brother's got his hat on back the front, and I said, stand beside that stone. I'm going to take a photograph of your feet with all those funny shoes, you know, little glittery ones and the ones that light up and everything. And I said, because the reason I want to take this photograph is because your grandmother worked on those grooves. Now, it was a guess, but she was in the district at the right time. It's improbable that she didn't spend time on that waterfall, the bank of that waterfall. And it moved me incredibly. And at the end of the day, I looked back at those girls and I thought, did that touch them at all? And they've referred to it another couple of times since. So I'm hoping that when they're 25, 26, 27, and I'd like to say when they've got their own children, but they've already got their own children. I hope they can tell those little kids about their feet in front of those grooves. It's a really vibrant cultural experience, and it's proof that it's so recent. Australian history is so recent. How come those people who made those grooves, living such a successful life, such a blissfully happy life, are now gone? They're not gone because their relatives are still there, but how come it was seen imperative to get rid of those people? And one of the excuses to get rid of Aboriginal people was because they were not using the land. They were hunters and gatherers. Convincing Ground was published by Aboriginal Studies Press. They had the option on this new book that I'm working on Aboriginal agriculture called Dark Emu, and they knocked it back because the professors on the board couldn't bear for me to use the word agriculture. I rewrote the Little Red and Yellow Black Book for them. On the first page, I wanted to talk about agriculture. They removed the word. I'll never forget it. And now, I know why.
Why?
You know, because they didn't believe it. They didn't believe that we could say agriculture. They thought it was, you know, pumping up Aboriginal people too much. And there's a lot of that goes on. You know, a lot of Aboriginal, people in defence of their culture try and overreach. But I didn't believe this was overreaching. Sir Thomas Mitchell and several other explorers in that region up in the Queensland, New South Wales border, Gregory, Giles, a lot of those people, Sturt in the centre, they saw Aboriginal people harvesting grain. Gregory saw them planting it. Some other bloke, whose name will come to me later on, saw them irrigating it from a dam that they had constructed. These are not the actions of hunters and gatherers. Down in Western Victoria, the Victorian Archaeological Survey investigated the Lake Conda houses and became ambivalent about whether they were houses or not. Looked at the fish traps, all wondered, oh dear, 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 is this accidental? And a lovely woman, I've never met her, Heather Booth, I don't know how to pronounce her name, hope that's right, Heather. She said, this is incredible. This lack of intellectual curiosity is incredible. Mm-hmm. She weighed every stone in all of those houses and with a mathematical formula proved that it couldn't have been an accident. It had to be the human hand. Science can measure these things. Why did it take until 2009 for science to intervene? And, you know, it's obvious that Aboriginal people had built stone houses down there. We find evidence of them all through the Western District. And Heather also said, and she was only backing up what Aboriginal people had already told her, but they said, you know, we lived on eels. She said, there has to be evidence of this eel culture here. And looked around, and there are all these old dead stags. She went to the base of each one. They were full of eel fat. They were smokehouses. The centre of the tree had been charred, dripping with fat. The base of it was full of fat. This was an industry that was going on. There was then engineering works had created the system, and then culinary works had created the preservation. One of the things they say about civilization is you have to intervene in the life cycle of plants. That is, you plant it, and if you plant it for 2,000 years, even 200 years, you start altering the genome of the plant. It becomes dependent on you. It gets used to being planted at the right time, so it alters itself. If you do it for 6,000 years or even 2,000 years, you make a profound impact on that plant. So this is what had been happening in Australia. We'd done it with grains. We'd done it with a plant called Michaelinus poides, and the Western District people had been doing it with eels. They'd probably also been doing it with grains. You know, you can't eat all potatoes. You've got to have some bread. And so if we start looking at our country like this, we'll find these examples. On this venerable radio station 3 weeks ago, I heard a very intelligent scientist talking about wild rice and saying how important it is. The wild rice that grows in Queensland is an Asian variety, but because it hasn't been hybridised as it has in Asia, it holds some properties that are very useful for that, the DNA and the, you know, how you you make new varieties of rice. But he said, fortunately, it had never been cultivated. And it just rang a bell. I thought, you know, Major Mitchell, the hero of Australian exploration, actually saw that this was not the case. Now, we're having a bit of a debate with those scientists at the moment, because now they're interested in whether or not that wild rice had been cultivated. And if it had been, then I believe there's an Aboriginal copyright in that plant. Mm-hmm. And the same with the grains that require one watering a year, that have been hybridised by Aboriginal people, there must be a copyright there. Now, Australia, when it comes time for these plants to be used, and they will be, please remember Aboriginal people. Make sure that Aboriginal people are on that board. Make sure that some credit is given. These things grow on sand, some of them. They need one watering a year. They're adapted to the Australian climate and to its pests. And these are valuable commercial products. They've been created by Aboriginal people. You know, all that great art from Alice Springs and Manning Greeter and places like that, there's a copyright in that art. We've agreed to that. There has to be a copyright in the foods. The yam daisy produces very, very sweet little tubers. It has to be a commercial product. The Victorian market, you know, all the cooking shows that are on, the first person who goes and cooks yam daisy is going to be a celebrity. Wacko, Sonny Jim. But, you know, it's possible. And why aren't we doing it? Why aren't we doing it? We, you know, we cook Mexican salsas and celebrate our ingenuity and our multicultural sensitivity. In Australia, we've got all these things, and we don't use them because they bespoke ownership. They bespoke history. Our Holden does not have a rear vision mirror. We cannot look over our shoulder. But, you know, the human animal is so diverse. There are people in it who are incredibly good. I meet them all the time. But now they have to be curious. It's not good enough to say, I've never met an Aboriginal person. I don't know much about Aboriginal history. Why don't you know much about Aboriginal history? What are you doing at night? What are you reading? More crime? We have to become an intelligent nation. We are an intelligent nation. We produce fantastic students all the time, but we have to be truly intelligent. We have to look backwards and say, this is intriguing. This is marvellous. This will make our country, because it'll be, we can't do it without each other now. It's not just going to be, you know, a black renaissance. It's black and white together. I think it's still so recent that the great-grandchildren of people who created the country can stand beside the evidence of that now in their Reeboks, and their hearts should swell with pride, and they should be determined that their children and their grandchildren love and respect the country and themselves. It's time for Aboriginal people to love themselves and refuse to allow their children to grow up in poverty, uneducated, unemployed, reviled. You know, we're not always going to be Nicky Winmar or the, you know, the wonderful Kathy. God love those people, but, you know, we can't exist on boxing gloves and running shoes. You know, we have to be part of the intelligence of the country, because we can't complain if we're not included, if we don't become part of the intelligence. And that's where Marcia Langton and people like that are so important. And now Anita Heiss, she's a true intellectual. You know, she reckons she writes chick lit. Anita, you know, she's an intellectual, a public intellectual, and she's so important. And, you know, Nicole Watson, the Watson family. Is there a Watson literature in Australia? You know, these wonderful people have to be given their head. Mm. And we have to teach our young people what these brave people have done, because without it, we'll be living on the bones of our ass.
The Storyteller, Bruce Pascoe. Dark Emu is soon to be published. his next book, and there is another one, called Imperial Harvest, and it's a novel about imperial greed, cruelty, and world history.